listen, listen, listen. God is speaking to us.
Kairos Milwaukee United Church of Christ presents For the Time Being, a sermon by the Reverend Rick Skidmore, presented on Sunday, January 5th, 2014.
So I think some of the greatest preachers aren't preachers at all, but poets. You just heard one in the Gospel of John. And later this month, you get to hear another as we profile the poet and the peacemaker and the word sorcerer, William Stafford, one of Oregon's favorite sons and premier poets, taught at Lewis and Clark College, was a colleague of our own Don Balmer. One of my favorite poets is W.H. Auden. He was born in England at the beginning of the 20th century, and in 1946 he became an American citizen, and 2 years after that he won the Pulitzer Prize for his poem, The Age of Anxiety. That's the poem that he's most noted for. But the poem that I most appreciate and would share with you this morning is entitled For the Time Being. And this particular poem, I think, is the perfect sermon for launching us all into the new year. And you'll notice that I made copies for everyone as a bulletin insert. So some of the images may seem to you dated, maybe even corny, but the poem is really rich with wisdom, written by someone who I think sees the world feelingly and sees into the unique character and mood of this climate, this time of year. And rather than just reading the poem and then singing the last hymn, I thought I would read a couple of verses and then offer some commentary on the images and the quandaries that this poet presents to us. So feel free to follow along. So the poem begins, well, so that is that. Now we must dismantle the tree, put the decorations back into their boxes, some have got broken, and carry them up to the attic. The holly and the mistletoe must be taken down and burnt, and the children got ready for school. There are enough leftovers to do, warmed up for the rest of the week. Not that we have much appetite, having ate and drank such a lot, stayed up so late, attempted quite unsuccessfully to love all of our relatives, and in general, grossly overestimated our powers. So I think there's something really poignant and powerful about leaving Christmas, about leaving the Christmas season. I mean, strings of lights are still up in my neighborhood, and some people don't take them down until Valentine's Day. But most of us, I would guess, most of us are happy to move on, left with certain impressions and memories from this Christmas past, and also half-eaten casseroles. I think the success or failure of the holiday season is rarely counted in terms of broken ornaments or gifts returned, but rather the poet says it's in this challenge to love all of our relatives, both near and far. And not just blood relatives, of course, but those who have become a part of our family by choice, which would include, hopefully, everybody in this room. Whatever the size or shape, I think it's rare for families to live in any kind of perfect harmony or mutual encouragement. Most of us have, through the years, come to terms with this reality. Only I think during the Christmas holidays, our expectations always sort of get raised up, and even the smallest disagreement or negligence can sometimes get exaggerated during the holidays. So while we may have been able to maintain a brief and cozy nostalgia around the traditions of Christmas, there's something I think quite nice and comfortable about sending the kids back to school and the relatives back home. We have not only overestimated our powers, I think we, in so many ways during the holiday season, overextend ourselves. And we are in need, among other things, of something ordinary for God's sake. An ordinary schedule, an uneventful day. But the poet here insists upon bringing up a disturbing, I think even a haunting occurrence. Sometimes surprisingly encountered in the mystery of Christmas, in a song that we sing, or in a gift that is given, or in some shared family ritual, or maybe even in the flicker of candles at the Christmas Eve service. And I quote, "Once again, as in previous years, we have seen the actual vision and failed to do more than entertain it as an agreeable possibility. Once again, we have sent him away, begging, though, to remain his disobedient servant, the promising child who cannot keep his word for long. The Christmas feast is already a fading memory, and already the mind begins to be vaguely aware of an unpleasant whiff of apprehension at the thought of Lent and Good Friday, which cannot, after all, now be very far off." So, the hunger that we have, you and I, at Christmas time, that hunger for love and for meaning and for transcendence, that's real. That's real. Our inner self, our inner eye, gazes at this promised Prince of Peace. And suddenly we see, you know, new possibilities, a new chance at wholeness, a new chance at centeredness and devotion and imagination and new perspective. But upon deeper reflection, we sense the cost, the changes, the sacrifices, the sacred obligations that we have if we are to walk this path. And so, like children, we go back to distractions. We go back to television, to the routine of work and play. A lot of good football to watch. Those endless stream of award shows are now beginning to show up on the tube. We got Downton Abbey is starting a new season. So the spiritual vision that you and I are the children of God is certainly an agreeable possibility, wouldn't you think? But we must finally set aside the thought if we're going to continue to be those disobedient servants the poet talks about. Ouch. I only know from my own experience that too oftentimes I betray the best that I know. I disobey or I ignore my highest aspirations. I don't forgive my enemies. I don't refrain from criticizing or judging others. I say things that hurt the very people I love and most treasure. I don't trust my life, my happiness to God. The Spirit of Jesus, which inspired so many, which took the breath away of those on that mountain who heard the sermon about the meek and the peacemakers, the Spirit of Jesus and the Spirit of every saint who comes with the message that there is this transforming love and peace and purpose inside each and every one of us. I mean, we applaud that. We hold it up to our children, right? We recommend it to our neighbors and to the whole world. But, this child disturbs our moral sleep. And so we send him away so that we can get back to the business at hand, so we can get back to the business of living. We really don't know how to cope with our own mortality or with anybody else's for that matter. And we're aware that it really is only a short time between Christmas and Good Friday, between birth and death, between endless possibilities and our own fragile finitude. And the poet acknowledges this whiff of apprehension in all of us, and returns with us to the real world, as the poem continues. For the time being, here we all are, back in our modern, moderate city. Euclid's geometry and Newton's mechanics account for our experience, and the kitchen table exists because I scrub it. It seems to have shrunk during the holidays. The streets are narrower than we remembered. We had forgotten that the office was as depressing as this. So you see, it's not without a certain sense, I think, of loss, a sense of restriction and narrowness that we engage once again in the ordinary tasks at hand, whatever those tasks are. I mean, once you've opened your heart just a little bit, once your eyes have glimpsed a greater wholeness, a greater harmony, once you've felt that comfort and joy and hope, it's harder to believe that life only consists of scrubbing the kitchen table or enjoying the familiar, the routine, the mundane, the ordinary pleasures of the world. The modern, moderate city is simply insufficient. Once you open your heart just a little bit. This summer, you know, we profiled some of my faith heroes, Albert Einstein and Thomas Merton and Simone Weil and Flannery O'Connor and let's not forget Roberto Clemente. And all of these people, I think why I found them so striking and so saintly is because all of them found, in their own way, they found that intelligence and agility and luxury and freedom and wit, that all of these things were insufficient, that all of these things were really narrower than they expected. And so they set out in search of something more. In search of something more sustaining and more substantial and more eternal. And so let's return to our poet. To those who have seen the child, however dimly, however incredulously, remembering the stable where for once in our lives everything became a you and nothing was an it. And craving the sensation, but ignoring the cause, we look round for something, no matter what, to inhibit our self-reflection. For once in our lives, everything became a you, and nothing was an it. For once in our lives, everything became a you, and nothing was an it. I think these words, for me, they really capture what religion and faith are all about, ultimately. We are connected, you and I, with everything that is. When we are related to God and everything, we are close to God's realm. And then everything in us becomes a blessing or a lesson, no longer alien or feared or resented. Because we are not an it. And the poet concludes with these words. In the meantime, there are bills to be paid, machines to keep in repair, irregular verbs to learn, the time being to redeem from insignificance. The happy morning is over, the night of agony still to come, and the time is noon. When the spirit must practice his scales of rejoicing. There you have it. There are bills to be paid. And somehow in our workaday dealings with family and community and with the government, with death and taxes and our parents and our kids, with each other, in all of those ordinary efforts and labors, we are asked, you and I are asked to find significance and meaning and a holy purpose. You up to it? To restore what would otherwise be cast off or displaced. To find in this body, in these bodies of ours, in this life, whatever the circumstances of our lives, to find those pleasures of the heart. To find the grace of God. To look to the grace that undergirds all things. And to trust that in every circumstance, in every season, in every condition of life. I'm talking grief as well as gladness, confusion as well as confidence. To trust the one who makes everything beautiful in time. And yeah, we'll go to the stable and we'll look around for anything to inhibit our self-reflection. We'll call everybody, all men and women, we'll call them our brothers and sisters, and then we'll isolate ourselves from them all. We'll feel that we are indeed, you know, a child of the Most High, and then we will experience ourselves as lost and dissatisfied. We'll believe in this world filled with beauty, and then we will do battle with bills and deficits and the wobbly machinery of government. There's a strange rhythm in this. I think that's what the poet is telling us. There's a strange rhythm in this process. And I don't for a moment begin to understand it, but what all the prophets and the poets and the psalmists and the preachers would urge is that we trust in the time being, which incidentally is what the term kairos means, is what the term kairos is all about. It's trusting in the moment. It's trusting in the time being, in our time together, however much time we have left. Trusting in that. I know it's paradoxical and confusing and just a little bit irritating to be in this world, you know, neither fish nor fowl. We are, you and I, we are hybrids. We're half ape and half angel. Not wholly of this world, not wholly religious. But when we finally come to terms with an existence that is both shadow and light, and good and evil, and consciousness and sleep, it's here that we discover that life is indeed this garden and that the Spirit of God walks with us every step. So, for the time being, let us sing praises. Let us rejoice in what makes us laugh and what makes us weep. Let us redeem the time being from insignificance by treating everything as a you and nothing as an it. Peace of God.
Listen, listen, listen.